Welcome to West of Centre, the Birmingham Fabians podcast brought to you by Not Enough Champagne. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and with me is the chair of Birmingham Fabians, Luke John Davis.
You right?
And also with me is fellow exec member of Birmingham Fabians Committee and councillor for Sharden, John Cotton.
Hiya.
Now, this episode is not about Birmingham, it's about the White House. Now, as is custom on Not Enough Champagne, if you are a regular listener, we are breaking our strict no alcohol rule, and we have a glass of wine in hand to talk about what is going on in the Trump White House and what might happen now. And I promise, no Scaramucci puns. Sorry, LJ. Basically, pretty acknowledged that that last week was the worst week for the Trump administration. I googled worst week Trump administration, and you get 1.6 million hits on Google, which in 6 months is quite impressive. Because if you Google worst week Blair administration, only gets 476,000 hits. Trump three times worse than Tony Blair. We could push
that. I mean, it's been the West Wing meets the Man in the High Castle. It's been an absolute fuss.
The kind of West Wing meets Monty Python.
Priebusly on the West Wing, right? Rance Priebus was the kind of the Republican Party insider who kind of got appointed to the Trump White House more or less under sufferance, really, not out of loyalty to Trump himself, but from the party establishment. And his ally was Sean Spicer. He then came under threat, so Sean Spicer resigned. Scaramucci then came in and replaced him, and had an interesting week where he rang up the New Yorker, forgot to say this is off the record, and lambasted everybody in the White House in an expletive-fueled rage.
Steve Bannon was going to blank his own blank.
Priebus got kicked out because he pledged he was going to get rid of Priebus within a couple of days. He did, and then John Kelly got rid of him. You've got this ridiculous situation where the only stable person in the White House is Steve Bannon. I mean, you know, the most unhinged individual in history has suddenly become the rock of the White House.
Whilst blanking his own bike, presumably.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like,
Trump complaining that his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, recused himself from the Russia inquiry. Trump has been lambasting him and calling him weak. And that has upset many Republicans because, you know, you can go after women and Democrats, but if you go after the racists, that's when Republicans really do close ranks.
But you've also started to see them break ranks. I mean, you had, this is, you know, one of the other things we've had is junior senator for Alabama, whose name's gone out of my head, has been secretly working on a book about how awful Trump
Jeff Fleck
is. Yes, Jeff Fleck. It's called The Conscience of a Conservative. That suddenly appeared and he starts ripping into Trump from page one. Three Republican senators scotched what they called the skinny repeal bill. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, who opposed it from the start. And then you had John McCain, obviously Senator for Arizona, former presidential candidate, who came in. And it was quite interesting to see the game he played, actually. I originally kind of went, why is McCain getting all this credit when there's two sort of female senators who've from the get-go been opposed to this and kind of blaming good old-fashioned sexism, which may well be part of it. But also what I didn't realise is that if the bill hadn't come to a vote, they could keep getting back to committee session, keep bringing it back and back and back. So McCain, by voting to allow it to come to a vote and then voting against it to defeat the vote, has kicked it into the long grass and scotched it for at least 12 months. They can't bring it back to the Senate. And it's sort of masterful sort of playing of the Senate rules in that sense. But it's interesting that, you know,
John Golding would be proud.
Well, yeah, but McCain, the kind of Obama's presidential opponent, is now kind of responsible for defending Obama's signature piece of legislation.
You've got the Boy Scout speech, which it's one of those Trump things where you read it and it sounds really bad, and then you watch it and you realise it's so much worse than that.
Yeah.
I mean, who'd have thought it was going to end like this?
Is it worse than you thought it would be?
It depends how much popcorn I've got.
Is it worse? Is it Is it as I expected? I think it's somewhere between the two.
It's
every time I think it can't be topped for complete mania and lunacy, it then promptly manages to do that. But I mean, the serious point is, you know, we're in a dangerous, unpredictable world. Mm. And this is the message that is coming out, that America is sending out to the world. This is the message the White House is sending out.
You've got a more and more confident and aggressive Russia. You've got
absolutely
North Korea now launching missiles that are capable of reaching the American mainland.
At which point, Tillerson, the Secretary of State, decides on Tuesday to go on vacation. I don't know if he's going to make jam. And because the
Russian inquiry is continuing apace. It now seems to have come out that Trump dictated the response to his son's meeting, or how it should have gone.
Listening to a podcast called Whistle Stop, I don't know if anyone...
Oh, yes, it's brilliant. It's
superb, isn't it? Brilliant. And I was listening to the one about Vice President, or former Vice President Agnew, and they mentioned there was an ad that the Democrats ran in that 68 election, which just consisted of the words Vice President Agnew and then 2 minutes of hysterical laughter. And that's kind of an analogy for where we are, you know, the Trump White House and the hysterical laughter. But of course, the serious message at the end of that ad was it would be a laughing matter if it wasn't so serious.
Mm.
And that's exactly where we are now.
The dynamic, it feels to me, is like one of those farcical Roman sex comedies. Along the lines of a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum or up Pompeii.
Yeah.
Where essentially you've got the clever slave who's trying to work for a big, pompous, bragging boss who's a little bit rubbish. And actually, there's an interesting play on that at the moment in Stratford called Vice Versa, which is based on plays by Plautus, who's a Roman playwright. And the idea is there's a clever slave and a big general braggadocio owner. And there's a big farce. Terrible things happen because the leader is a muppet. But eventually, everything is okay because the clever slave makes everything all right in the end. And you can see the clever slave idea in things like Jeeves and Wooster, and you can see it in things like Blackadder as well. It's this idea of like the
clever underling, I think might be a better way of phrasing it.
But yeah, it's a slave in ancient Rome, LJ. I'm not going to bow down to political correctness and the niceties of ancient Rome. So the thing is, who is going to be the clever slave in the Trump White House that makes everything okay? It wasn't really obvious who that was going to be. It's quite possible that John Kelly, everyone's favourite four-star general, new chief of staff, because obviously Trump likes generals, which is a little bit worrying. But do we think that John Kelly is the clever slave who makes everything okay?
The troubling thing about the up Pompeii analogy is we all know what ultimately happened to Pompeii.
Whoa, whoa, and thrice whoa!
I don't think
it was Frankie Howard's fault.
But despite Frankie Howard's best efforts, it was all wiped out in a cataclysmic event, which kind of troubles me about where some of this stuff goes.
That's why we're in the Not Enough Champagne bunker.
Yes, with a plentiful supply of wine, frankly. The interesting thing is that the Kelly appointment, certainly the early signs are that there's now a greater grip on the administration of the White House.
Yeah.
I was reading something today, there's even a suggestion that Trump's actually starting to pay attention to some of his briefings and is almost trying to impress his own chief of staff by showing that he's on top of things, which is a first. How long that lasts, I think, is a really moot point.
Promise no puns.
How do you deal with a renegade president? I mean, the American system is full of checks and balances. There was some debate or rumours that Trump was preparing to split his presidency away from the Republican Party, which would be an interesting, you know, how long would Congress kind of remain loyal if he did that? I don't think it would be particularly long. How do you predict what's going to happen? You can't.
And this is the thing, I suppose, when you're like, process is important and governing is important. And I suppose it's the problem of populism, in a sense, of what happens when you've got a populist who comes in. Like we've talked on Not Enough Champagne about how the rules of campaigning seem to be slightly different, but the rules of politics, of how you actually get things done, they're still pretty similar. And if you have senators, Lisa Murkowski, for instance, a senator for Alaska who is against healthcare reform, Trump then tweets and threatens to cut off federal funding for Alaska because of her support for healthcare, which A, is stupid. B, he couldn't probably do anyway, and see just most of the things that a president can do is the bully pulpit. It's about having the power to persuade. Eventually, it's like if you've got a teacher that keeps shouting at a class, like eventually those shouts just lose any effect and it's just white noise.
It's a bully pulpit, but it only works if you're not behaving essentially like a bully.
Yeah.
Trump is the classic bully. It's all bluster, it's all front, it's all a lot of noise. I think the other thing that this is illustrating is actually what a powerless institution as an executive institution the US presidency actually is, because of the checks and balances that are built into the Constitution. I mean, it's rather frightening to think what would be happening if there was some sort of untrammeled executive power sat with this current president. So it's kind of an argument for the checks and balances in the system. But the danger is, I think, that you end up with a kind of stasis in terms of nothing happens in terms of legislation or the domestic program, but the signals it sends out from a country that is still, you know, de facto leader of the free world, and the opening it creates for others in a very unstable global environment. Mm. That's the really frightening part of all of this.
It is. To return to the Lisa Murkowski example, there's two interesting aspects of that come out of it. First is Trump is a reality TV star in this. And in reality TV, right, there is no de-escalation of conflict because it destroys the ratings. Conflict has to be reinforced and improved, which is why his only response is that kind of aggressive bullying. Now, the second thing that is just how little he understands the process and the way the Hill works, because the way he tried to bully Lisa Murkowski was to get the Interior Secretary to ring her up and remind her of how much money goes to Alaska and that it could be under threat.
Nice now, state you've got, shame if something happened.
Pretty much. But here's the problem with that, right? Lisa Murkowski is the chair of A, the committee that runs the Interior Department, and B, the Appropriation Committee that funds the Interior Department. So he has got a guy to ring up his boss and funder and say, we're going to threaten you. That
drain the swamp.
Yeah, how does, you know, it's he just doesn't, but he's done it clearly because he's gone, he's got vague power over Alaska, we'll get him to bully, without realising or knowing that actually, you know, he's got the underling to try and threaten the boss.
Hmm. In terms of the lack of understanding of process and policy, the tweets, and again, we've managed to go 10, 15 minutes and not mention the transgender ban on the military, which Trump tweeted out last week, which
and
is
then the chief of staff said they weren't going to do until they received something in writing.
Well, it needs to be proper channels, not Twitter, but the fact that it comes in three tweets, and the first one is something to the effect of, after consulting with my generals, I will, or have decided I will have, dot, dot, dot. And in those 9 minutes, the generals are thinking, what? Are we at war with Korea? What is going on?
You almost thank God for the checks and balances there, but is the American system actually set up to deal with a rogue president?
I mean, the thing I think about, and again, it's probably a Not Enough Champagne episode rather than a big topic here, but it is, in Britain, we have an unwritten constitution. A lot of the Trump stuff is the overturning of norms. You're meant to have an attorney general that will recuse himself from an inquiry if he has to. The point of a justice secretary is not to do justice for the president. In Britain, if you had a populist prime minister who was bent on overturning those norms that we've got, it would be much easier for a prime minister like that, left or right, to do a lot of damage and be quite authoritarian in a way that Trump's more authoritarian, more fascistic instincts are at least curbed by the system.
Yeah.
In Britain, they wouldn't be, and that I find scary. Hashtag PR now. Hashtag electoral reform.
I mean,
hashtag laws reform. Hashtag written constitution.
You're caught in this sort of scenario that is it a landslide or is it the kind of ordinary working of politics in times of stress? How much is Trump an expression of that's seen before in Nixon, that's seen before in some of the older historical US presidents that the system is set up to cope with and deal with? And how much of it is a changing of the underlying realities of the political system in America? Is there an escape from that? Well, how can you tell without testing the system to destruction?
Well, I suppose the interesting thing with Nixon is he was a kind of mixture of the very, very moderate Republican strand and the very, very radical authoritarian strand. So in Nixon, you have the setting, I'm pretty sure the setting up of EPA, So a lot of those kind of more liberal reforms, you know, I in a previous life read some Michael Moore books. Michael Moore thinks that Nixon did some quite nice liberal things, which is an interesting statement from Michael Moore. Probably didn't say the same about Bill Clinton. Almost with Nixon, it's that tortured, and a lot of the stuff that Nixon does, Watergate, in terms of the more authoritarian stuff, it comes from that Cold War mindset where you do secret authoritarian stuff. Like, say, the deal with going to China, which and some things are fine to keep secret if you find out about it, and then Watergate obviously isn't.
And there's also just a deep insecurity in terms of Nixon's personality. But, you know, the thing
which thankfully is not there with Trump.
It's, you know, the Trump thing is a completely different scale. And, you know, Nixon was, of course, somebody who had held various senior offices. You know, he'd been vice president, he contested a governorship, you know, and as you say, there was a record of sensible liberal legislation sat alongside the paranoia and the neurosis that eventually led to him having to resign the presidency. What we're talking about here is, I can't think really of a historical parallel for Trump, other than perhaps Andrew Jackson, but you know, you're going back to the late 1820s there.
The Republican Party in Congress. You know, are they going to kind of sort of open their eyes almost and say, you know, he's electorally successful, but are they going to, you know, turn around and say our principles mean that we need to sort of rescue the way the presidency works?
Well, clearly, what happens in the midterms is going to be crucial in all of this. So, my understanding is that there's a strong chance that the Democrats would take back the House, but the Senate, I think, it probably looks more difficult.
I think the most Senate seats are in quite traditional Republican areas.
Yeah.
I mean, impeachment is a political question. And I don't think there's any chance of that before the midterms at all. If in 2 years' time, even if the Republicans have a Senate, if the Democrats have the House, which they should with a half-decent campaign, if there's a primary challenge to Trump in 2019... which surely someone to God is going to challenge Trump for the Republican nomination. Well, if in 2 years' time you've got a disunited Republican Party, you've got a primary challenge, if the Democrats have the House, then they can start doing Russian inquiries as well.
I can't see a Democratic-controlled House, if we have one after 2018, not voting to start a process.
It's a question of whether
no impeachment has ever successfully gone through the Senate anyway. But of course, at that point, it just effectively even further paralyzes the ability of the administration to do anything else.
Just Trump sticking out. I mean, you know, he'd never really wanted to be president, let's be honest. He was running as a gimmick. Does he leave it all behind?
Or
does he face the truth?
I think he would have to be levered out.
And also, what happens to Trump's base is interesting. So, you know, Watergate as a process took 2.5 years, and it's only been 6 months, and obviously in Trump terms, that's 4.5 years. Nixon still had the support of a majority of Republican voters when he resigned over the Watergate affair. It's quite possible, although Trump's approval rating is historically low, amongst Republicans it's not too bad.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, it's almost the Millwall syndrome, right? You know, nobody likes us nobody loves us and we don't care. And it's, you know, do they see him still as the repository of all their hopes? And how much do the betrayal narrative come in, right? I mean, this is something we'll probably see with Brexit as well. Like, you know, how much is it a case of him turning around to the base and going, I've been betrayed by the Republican Party?
Well, that's exactly what it will be, though, wouldn't it? But the Boy Scout speech, which, if you haven't seen it, listeners, do. It's terrible. In the interview, in a recent interview, Trump took issue with the fact one of the reporters said it had a mixed reception. Bear in mind that the Boy Scouts actually had to apologise for the fact they invited Trump to give the speech. But Trump said that the Boy Scouts people, that the head of the Boy Scouts, phoned him to say it was the greatest speech that was ever made to the Boy Scouts. Now, this is a man who I think will create his own fables and believe whatever nonsense he makes himself believe. The narrative sells himself will be one of betrayal. He will not honestly acknowledge his own failings.
The truth is whatever he can persuade himself and others to believe is true.
That's a better way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah. Does it really matter in the sense of his re-election, or is it just a case of whatever they do, his base is going to stick with him through thick and thin?
The thing that also interests me in all this is the legitimacy that his presidency has, given that he's starting from a base of, 3 million votes behind the Democrats. That's where I think the Nixon analogy breaks down a bit. You know, Nixon in 72 won a landslide. Every state, I think. Whereas, you know, Trump starts in a position where he's 3 million votes behind. It's only because of the accident to the Electoral College he's there. To a far greater extent than it was an accident to the Electoral College that Bush Jr. was there.
Hashtag Oath Reform.
Well, Bush Jr. and Oath for a statesman in the White House. Well, and there's the other interesting question about how do the Democrats now respond to this? Are they going to get their act together in a meaningful way? Because clearly, you know,
they need a Bill Clinton, Joe Biden, man of the people kind of character, or woman of the people if they've got one. But
and half I think decent policies. I think that there's a majority in America now for a single payer healthcare system. I think it's about being a little bit bold.
Again, going to the Blue Labour thing, it's about putting jobs and people's livelihoods front and centre.
Well, and I think part of the problem with the Democrat campaign last time was it was almost based on that you've got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a Trump presidency is so ludicrous. Why would you vote anywhere else?
And Theresa May mistake.
Yeah, and absolutely. And we saw what the result of that campaign was. So, and I'm not close enough to that part of the debate to understand fully how the Democrats are responding to that. But clearly they need to do some deep thinking here about how...
There's a danger they go down the Sanders route and this idea that, you know, a very, very liberal person could take him on, which I think is not the case. I think that would justify Republicans to stick with him. I think there is a danger that they go down the same route again and essentially kind of blame Hillary Clinton, which I think is unfair in that, you know, she was kind of forced to be the most professional of candidates and then punished for being a professional candidate. I mean, to me, they need to go with someone who takes the fight to Trump. Trump won because he addressed economic insecurity and cultural insecurity. Now, certainly on economic insecurity, the Democrats ought to be hammering that. But someone who comes, like Bill Clinton did, a man of the people, comes and puts jobs and livelihoods and the economy absolutely front and centre and takes Trump on that ground, that's the way they've got to do it, I think.
I also think there is something just about the dignity of the office. And I think this is something that certainly my sense of talking to Americans is, you know, and it's also because it's not just head of government, it's head of state. You know, in a different way to, you know, how perhaps we look at a prime minister over here because we have, you know, somebody else who acts as head of state. So there's a kind of national pride and prestige that sits around that role. My sense is that, you know, talking to people, that sense of just cringing national embarrassment, frankly, that this is our spokesperson to the world.
Shall we go to the important question, which is, what does this mean for us?
We don't hear Britain talked about much these days, according to the interview.
No, that was an amazing quote. So Trump, in a recent interview, said, "I can say we're going to be very involved with the UK. I mean, you don't hear the word Britain anymore." I don't know. Does he think it's somehow politically incorrect to talk about Britain? Do we think there's going to be a nice, big, massive trade deal between Britain and America?
Well, see, this
it'll
is
be the best deal. It'll be the best deal.
Absolutely. Well, this is quite interesting because, you know, it's been rumoured that the price for that would be that we have to accept chlorinated chicken, which led to one of my favourite headlines, which is stop obsessing over chicken, says Fox. But also that we have to allow American healthcare companies to buy parts of the NHS, which sort of actually makes sense. Suddenly the £350 million for the NHS makes sense as a slogan because that's how much we're going to charge the Americans to buy the NHS.
I mean, it's too soon. It's okay.
all of this is just eyewash, isn't it?
If
you cannot get your signature policy commitment to reverse affordable healthcare through Congress... I mean, are we seriously going to see major trade deal by this president?
The other thing is that he spent, you know, most of his campaign condemning free trade deals.
Exactly.
You know, if he then turns around and says, yeah, but we're going to get a free trade deal with Britain because, you know, it's better than Canada. I mean...
That's enough of Trump. We'll be back. The next Western Centre podcast is about Blue Labour, which is nothing to do with Trump, you were pleased to know. LJ, how can the lovely listeners follow the lovely Birmingham Fabians on that World Wide Web they have now?
There's a multiple of ways. They can follow us on Facebook. We have a Facebook page, Birmingham Fabian Society. They can follow us on Twitter, which is at BHamFabians, all one word. Or you can email us, which is BHamFabians, again, all one word, at gmail.com. we will very happily talk to you or put you on the mailing list. Get in touch.
And we're crowdsourcing a manifesto for Birmingham Locals 2018. A Muslim ban into Birmingham is not one of the options that we're considering.
It's not. No.
But if you have other policies that you would like to see the
council... We might build a wall. We will make Coventry pay for it.
It'll be out of concrete. Beautiful, beautiful concrete. Follow me on Twitter at paperbackrioter.
I'm at LJDavies87, Davies with an E.
And I've got the most followers since George Washington at Councillor John Cotton.
Happy plotting. And also with me is, I've forgotten who you are. It's a good start.
His name's Scaramucci. It's an exclusive.